Let's continue with the next presentation from Peter Bloom from Rhizomatica, telling us about the rural GSM projects or rural cellular projects that they have been doing.
Seems my computer's not happy with the display. Maybe something's going on. Sorry, one second. Okay. Ugh. Sorry, guys. There we go. Yes. Okay, so I'm going to share with you a bit about our work as Rhizomatica. We are based in different places. I live in Mexico, which is kind of where the organization started. I don't know why is this doing this. Anyway, so we are basically working with different communities in different parts of the world to try to help them build autonomous GSM networks. What I mean by that, mainly, the main factor is it's working directly with communities, and also there's usually no core network. If you want to take it from a technical perspective, that's generally the main difference. So we're working in a few different countries. We have been helping people in Brazil, in Colombia. We've been working in Mexico for quite a while, which is where we started, and then also supporting some folks in Nicaragua. And I think it's like on some timer or something. So I'm going to tell you first about the networks in Brazil. The gentleman from Wave Mobile said his talk wouldn't be technical. This is definitely not going to be technical. There'll be pictures of people. This thing is cycling through. Anyway, sorry. So there are a few different sites in Brazil. There's three different places. I can show them to you on a map here. So the first one is this place, Calungas, which is basically right in the center of the country. It's an area with no coverage whatsoever of anything. And this is what's known as a quilombola community. So folks who were slaves who escaped and created a community kind of as far away as humanly possible from anybody else, which is why there's no coverage and also why things have kind of stayed the way that they are. So not much electricity, no roads, so on and so forth. So we are working with a group there called Red Mocambos, and you can see here, like, crossing the river, so it's quite difficult to get there. Sorry, I have to show it to you like this. My bad. So we went and with the community, Keith was there as well, and we helped them set up a small base station, actually using a Sysmo BTS 1020. With an Omni antenna on top of a water tower, which is the tallest thing that they have in the community. It's using all solar power. And then they had built, previous to that, a pretty complex Wi-Fi backhaul system. So they were also doing sort of Wi-Fi, general Wi-Fi services for people's phones mainly. And then we kind of attached the GSM network to that. This was built last year, at the end of last year, so about a year ago, a little bit less than a year ago. You can see here we're having a meeting with the folks in the village. This is kind of like the center of town. And then putting the solar system together. This guy here on the right got really excited and decided he wanted to do the installation. So that's actually our harness that I brought all the way from Mexico. And here he is climbing up the tower with different ladies from the village watching him go up the tower. But he was super excited. He did a great job with the installation. Not obviously ideal conditions. But he was excited. I think he, more than anything, wanted to be able to use the harness, honestly. And here's people using the system. This network has had a number of different challenges in terms of the power system, in terms of the backhaul. This is kind of the least well-working of these different sites. This is really challenging. It's really hard to get there. So from the capital, Brasilia, you have to drive 3 hours to get to a city called Cavalcanti, and then from there, another 2 or 3 hours into basically the, quote, middle of nowhere. There are people living there, obviously, but no electricity, no service of any kind. So it's difficult for the organizations that are based in the city to continue to provide support. But hopefully it'll go on. We then have another partnership in a different part of the country, so in the north. in the sort of where the Amazon kind of ends. There it would be here. So we'll go up further into Brazil. So this is basically a huge river here that ends up, if you go out into, this is the Atlantic Ocean, basically. So there's two sites. We're working with a university there, the Federal University of Pará, who have a project called CELCOM. And they have basically decided they wanted to work on GSM. I think Harold actually was there, or sort of previous iteration of that project at some point, maybe 2000, when were you there, 2011? Maybe, yeah. Anyway, it's the same group of people that you... Okay, but it's the same group. That group started doing GSM stuff, so that was a nice little... They're like, oh, yes, you know Harold? He was here in whatever year. I was like, what? So there's two sites. One site, this is Boa Vista. So using a light cell, the university bought two light cells and some antennas. And they're using RCCN, which is a system that Rizomatica developed to do billing and routing and just make it easy for people locally to manage the network, which I can talk a little bit more about later. This is a place you can only get to by boat. I think theoretically you can get there by road, but it's like six times longer to do that. So by boat you go. It's only like half an hour from the city of Belém, which is over 1 million people. Here's Keith with his Sismocom shirt and with some guys from the university, figuring out what the hell's going on with the VoIP situation. There's the tower, and yeah, that's it. Not that exciting, but there's another site called Campo Verde, which is further inland, so not by river, you go by road. Another site with them. This is also a Quilombola community, about 3 hours from Belém by road. That's me, got to go up the tower, doing the installation. So that's Brazil. There's, like I said, there's three sites in Brazil, one in the center, and then two up in Pará. Again, all of them are obviously using Osmocom software, totally Osmocom software, plus the stuff that Rizomatic has developed for the local management. We also have a project in Colombia with an NGO, an NGO that works on like digital rights and things of that nature, called Clonodo, who are based in Bogota, in the capital. And they're working in a region called Cauca, which is sort of in the southwest of the country, a region famous for growing coca, actually, for the main ingredient of cocaine. So it's actually a very interesting place, very... a place that's had a lot of conflict, a lot of violence. So some crazy stories from the people there that we heard. We actually ended up setting the BSC up in a gymnasium, an open air gymnasium. That was the last place where the FARC rebels had attacked the army. And there's actually like bomb, there's craters. I can show you a picture later. There's craters and bullet holes everywhere. So that's where the BSC is. this is a really interesting network too, because this organization called Nolo they're using different technologies. So they have access. There's a national fiber backbone, so they were able to gain access to that. And from where that is, using TV white spaces, which is actually legal in Colombia, which is not the case almost everywhere else, are able to do their backhaul from the sites to this fiber. So it's actually a pretty interesting thing. This is now, I don't even know if Keith has seen this, this is now what the network looks like. So Buenos Aires right here, this is where the fiber is. And then this is going up, and you can sort of see to repeaters and to different places. It's definitely not the capital of Argentina. So here's where this place is. Fuck you, okay. Sorry, where is this? Here. So up to Colombia, this is the Cauca region, and then this is also, if you sort of can see, basically in the middle of nowhere. This area is very interesting because there are campesino communities, so like peasant farmer communities. There are also Afro-Colombian communities and indigenous communities who are all part of this network. So they actually, jokingly, but I think maybe have now actually decided to have this be the official name. They created a name which in Spanish basically means uncommunicated or not in communication, INC, incomunicados. But the INC is indígenas, indigenous people, negros, black people, and campesinos, the farmer peasants. So the name is Incomunicados, which is the sort of name that they gave to this project of them all working together. So this is actually, like I said, a much more complex network than the other ones, which are just kind of one-off, one base station networks. So there's a light cell, there's a Fairwaves site, and then they're basically connected together using an external BSC. So the BSC sits on a hilltop, and then on another hilltop is the is this. So this is a light. This is a guy who's an electrician installing, a light cell on a power mast. So this is a multiple ton cement pole that the community dragged up the side of this mountain and installed themselves. And there's a video of it, actually. It's pretty amazing. And then they use this as a place to mount the BTS and also to run power up the hill. So they actually have like a little sort of medium tension electrical line that they ran the day that the installation happened. And actually you can see on the top here, you have the antennas sticking out of the cross support beam of the what would normally be an electrical installation. Very dangerous to then change anything on the BTS if you need to. But all this was installed before they installed the power lines. So we strongly suggested that they didn't do it this way, but this was how they decided to do it. So that's great. And then here's one of the Wi-Fi repeaters in the hill between where that community is. So this one that's up here is mainly covering Afro-Colombian community, so black folks who have been living in the region for a very long time. And then it's interconnected with this site, which is in an indigenous village, like two mountainsides over. This here is a Fairwaves site, also on a pole. We basically had them build a pole, which was just soldering two poles together, dig a hole, stick it up, and there it is. So here's a picture of folks signing themselves up. So that network is there. I'm gonna talk more about some of the challenges later. And then our biggest network is this network in Oaxaca. Oaxaca is in southeast Mexico. So we have quite a few sites. So if I zoom over to Mexico, where are you, Mexico? Here it is. Oops. So you can see here, all of these pins are different sites that we have in Oaxaca. So they're all over different places. This part in the middle here is the capital city. That's where I live. And then here are all the different sites that we have in different parts, different rural areas of the place. So there's 14 rural communities. What we have in Mexico is much further along. It's been operating for much longer. So down here on the right-hand side is the logo of the operator. The operator is actually a not-for-profit organization that we helped start in conjunction with the communities themselves and some other organizations. It's called Telecomunicaciones Indígenas Comunitarias, which basically means indigenous community telecommunications. So it's a not-for-profit organization that is organized similarly to a cooperative. So the 14 rural communities are the owners and operators of 14 autonomous, completely separate networks. And they are federated. That's, I think, for me, the easiest way to understand the network. It's a federation. So there is an organization that represents and also includes the voice of, and the decisions made are made by the members who are these communities. And the association also has the frequency use permit and is basically a completely, fully legal social GSM operator. So we have a spectrum concession or license in 850 megahertz, which basically allows that organization to manage that portion of spectrum. So we're allowed to add new communities as long as they're not covered by anybody else. which in the case of where we are is many communities. So right now it's 14 community member communities. There are 17 BTSs. So there's one community that has two BTSs and one community that has three BTSs now. There's coverage in 63 localities, and there's approximately, on any sort of given day, about 3,500 users using the network. It's about 115,000 outbound minutes per month. That's not including the minutes that are happening inside the network. This is just long distance, and then about four times that inbound traffic. So all of these sites are connected to the internet and are using voice over IP to do calling in and out of the sites. Calling within the sites is free, and between the sites is completely free. So we don't even—I mean, we could get the statistics, but we don't even track how many minutes that is. But it's many hundreds of thousands of minutes of people calling within their villages and then between the different villages. The first site was installed in 2013, so we're coming up on, I think we passed already 5 years of since the first network has been up, and have basically most of what we do and most of what we sort of have done in Brazil or Colombia is all based on the work that happens in Oaxaca. So this is kind of like the main test bed, the main place where we have lots of users and things break and we have to fix them and where we develop new services and so on. There's one other spot I don't have too much information on because they're kind of in stealth mode for the moment. I don't know what's going on, but there's a place in Nicaragua called Pearl Lagoon. If you want to know more about them, you can check out their website, seycell.com. Edwin, who works with them, was here last year, actually, at the last one. Pearl Lagoon is basically on the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua, right about there. So they're also folks who we've supported in the past, and I hope we'll support in the future, once they kind of figure out what they want to do. So that's a presentation of the different networks that we know of that exist that we've directly participated in. And I just wanted to speak a little bit about the challenges. So you could see the place. One of the ideas of showing pictures was just kind of get an idea of like what the places look like, what the people look like, what the installations themselves look like. There's many challenges. So getting all the software and all the hardware to work obviously is a challenge. But beyond that, keeping it all running in the conditions, adverse conditions, is also difficult. So starting from the bottom, weather and distance can be very extreme. So we have lots of lightning strikes. We've spent a lot of time in Mexico focusing on lightning protection, like how to do essentially like open source cheap lightning protection for towers and other installations so that things don't get destroyed by lightning and other things like that. And just how do you, so like the first network that I showed in Calungas, since it's so far away from support, when something happens with the network, the response time can sometimes be pretty slow in terms of someone with a little more expertise being able to go, which takes me to the next point. Technical knowledge is limited. And I think, so we work with universities, we work with folks who have like master's degrees in telecommunications, and even for them, I think sometimes dealing with the software, the Osmo project specifically, take this as a constructive critique, but it can be very hard. There's a lot of stuff that has to get configured, and then there's also like configuring all the Osmo stuff and then getting it to work with the VoIP system and all these other things. It can be very, very challenging, and I think one of the things we expected or hoped over time is that the folks that we work with, our partners, would increasingly take on responsibilities for some things, and that has been difficult just due to the like really high, steep learning curve for getting involved in the project. So that remains a challenge. I'm not sure what exactly the solution to that is. Just kind of, I guess, keep hammering at it, but certainly that's a piece of this. So I think if we, obviously the open source aspect, the free software aspect, allows more people to get involved, but I think there is also this layer of complexity where there's a whole lot of other people who just find it kind of like beyond their scope or their ability to even understand or to implement. Second from top here, policy and regulation gaps. So the networks in Brazil that I showed, those have an experimental license to use 900 megahertz frequencies, which Brazil is a little bit weird with that frequency. So that should be ISM, but they also, it's GSM, so it's very bizarre how they decided to do the frequency use regulation around that particular band. Anyway, the government gave the university an experimental license, but to do multiple sites, which was kind of like a negotiation that had to happen with the regulatory agency there called Anatel. So the university, which is based in Belém, is essentially saying to the regulator, we have multiple sites where we're doing our experiments. Some of them are nearby by the university, some of them are not. So there's a network in the middle of the country in Goiás. There's also one in the state of Rio. And those are under this umbrella of this this frequency use experimental permit. The case with Colombia is a little bit different. I think we are now in our second year of negotiations and trying to get the government to sign a piece of paper. They've agreed to it. They like the idea. We've met with the ministers. We've met with every possible person. The regulatory authority is into it, but the person who needs to sign the paper will not sign the paper. So that network is actually not even on, unfortunately. The big issue with all of this is the frequencies. It has mainly to do with spectrum. So can you operate a telecom service or a internet service? Yes, but if you want to use frequencies, forget about it. And the case of Colombia is very interesting because as part of these negotiations, we said we will use a non-standard band for the service. So Colombia uses, and the lower bands, uses 850 for GSM, and what we said is we'll use 900 since there's nothing there. So it's not, there's literally nobody else using that band. So unfortunately, we're still waiting to get the paper signed. If it were me, I would have turned the network on already. But since we're working with other partners, it's really up to them. They're the ones who have to deal with the fallout of operating an unlicensed network. I believe it will happen. I hope it will happen. In the meantime, they've done a lot. They got access to fiber. They got access to TV white space. It's going to allow them to run on things beyond just GSM, which I think is fantastic. And so hopefully that will come online soon. The idea with these experimental or sort of... So the experimental license in Brazil is for 2 years. So it's a little different than what might be an experimental license here, which might be for like 2 days or something. So you have 2 years to sort of show that this is a viable thing. This is how we started in Mexico. So in 2014, we got an experimental license in Mexico, again, for 2 years. And then in those 2 years, we just basically built out the network, or much of what the network is today was actually built out in those 2 years. And then essentially from there said, look, this is a viable thing. It's helping people, it's serving people, it's affordable, it's sustainable. You know, there's problems and so on, but basically where there was no coverage before, there now is coverage. It saves the government money. You know, it increases economic activity in the towns. It helps people in many, many ways in these rural areas. So that was then transitioned into a more formal, permanent license. And the experimental period actually coincided with the laws being rewritten. And as the laws were being rewritten, what we were doing was taken into account, and then they created a category of social operator. So in Mexico now, you can be a commercial operator like the big MNOs are, but you can also be a social operator, which just basically says, you know, I'm a non-for-profit organization, or I, for some reason, need coverage somewhere, you can apply for a license now. We also recently defeated the government with a bunch of legal challenges. So a social operator doesn't have to pay for spectrum. Like, you don't have to go through an auction process, and you're allowed to basically request direct assignment, which is actually quite fantastic. So if we present a solid case for why we need to use certain spectrum, the government is under some kind of obligation to provide that spectrum, within reason, obviously. But when that law or regulation came into existence, they didn't change the tax law. So basically, we got our license in 2016, the permanent license, and then they said, okay, but now you owe us taxes. The tax bureau said, you know, we received notification from the regulator that you're using the spectrum, and like, here's the equation that we use to charge for spectrum. So they wanted to charge us on the order of like $60,000 per year in taxes, something like that. So we took them to court. We took the regulator to court. We took the tax bureau to court. And we just won the second and final case. So now we don't owe them taxes either, which is great. Thank you. So that was actually a very interesting process because the community said, look, you know, you've given these huge concessions to mobile operators. They don't come and do coverage where we live. You as the government also have a responsibility. Like, your first responsibility is to the people, and the way that you sort of dispense with that responsibility is to give state assets to the mobile operator, but the mobile operator doesn't operate here because it's not a good business opportunity for them. The government doesn't do anything either, so we ourselves have built and financed. So all the networks in Oaxaca are financed by the communities themselves. So the community said, you know, we're just basically trying to exercise our right to communication, and we've built these communication networks to be able to have basic, you know, life-saving, in many cases, communication. You shouldn't then come and tax us because we did that. And that was successfully held up in federal court. So up to the final thing. So financial resources are limited sometimes. In the case of Oaxaca, many communities are able to finance the network. Obviously, we try to keep it as reasonable as possible, but many of you know what the base station costs, and so you add the tower and the site costs and all these things. And we have installations that cost, you know, about $5,000. This is all the equipment imported, installed. That would be like a really small site. And up to ones that can cost up to like $15,000 with towers and grounding and all of that. So some communities are able to afford that, but many are not. Like the case of Brazil, those communities, very, very unlikely that they would be able to afford that. So we have to find financial resources from other places to do that. That is evolving. So it's generally been grants from foundations. We're hoping that governments themselves will start recognizing this as a way to deal with the connectivity issues in their country, and as a way to also just allow people to exercise their rights, and possibly, you know, using universal service funds or these other things. So one of the arguments that we're making is to say, you know, the general way that networks are rolled out respond to certain population densities, conditions, and so on. And it probably doesn't, like, you can try to force operators to operate, but it's not necessarily what their business model is. So as much as you want to force them, they're going to resist, and they're probably not going to do a good job. So what we see a lot of times is at some point the government subsidized the operator to go somewhere, and then the minute something breaks or stops working, that's just the end of it. So it stops, and then they never go back. So our kind of argument is to say we need to have other kinds of networks, other ways of organizing, other ways of finding sustainability in order to make this work. So the costs in the network, so what we try to do is we run, at least in Mexico, what we call cost-oriented networks. So basically the guiding principle is, how much is it going to cost for the end user to use the network, and how can we make that as low as possible? So in Mexico right now, people between, this is like an average, but people pay an average of about $6 per month for all of their calling. Some of that is a maintenance fee that they sort of charge themselves to keep their network running and have money to pay for the infrastructure, and another $2 or $3 that they're spending on the long distance calling that they're making. So I guess I'll leave it there, and if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
So you've excluded the technical part entirely. What's most interesting detail for me is, since cellular networks are mostly centralized with a central MEC, how do you solve the problem of having resilient, independent networks that can still call each other? And do you share phone numbers? Do you have the same phone number everywhere? And how do you synchronize that?
So I can answer the second part. The first part is a great advertisement for the talk that Keith is going to do tomorrow, I think, right? About it's a challenge. So the actual architecture of the network is something that, yeah, we're like pushing the limits and somewhat beyond the limits of how GSM is supposed to work. Which I think part of it is when we started, there was one network. So just like having it all there was great. But then now there's 14 or 15 or however many networks. And that becomes quite complicated because there's no core network. And just as you say, so there's some proposals that are on the table, and Keith is going to present kind of what we're thinking about and some stuff we've been talking to Harold about how to deal with that. The second part, so what we do is we rent numbers from a termination or a VoIP provider. So each community, for cost reasons, each community has one number that you can call in, or sometimes two. So for example, many of the communities in Oaxaca, people live in the US, so we assign a US number and a Mexican number to the site. You call in, Free Switch answers your call and says, hey, thanks for calling the community. You just put in an extension, which is the person's number. Calling outbound, so from your cell phone out of the community, is much more straightforward. So that's how we handle that. And we have an inbound traffic termination provider. We actually spend more money to receive calls than we do to make calls. Part of that is due to the amount of traffic. So there's about four times more calls that come in than go out. Maybe due to cost, maybe due to some other reasons. We're not totally sure exactly what, but we actually pay more to receive the calls than we do to make the calls. So we're spending between incoming and outgoing per month, we spend maybe like $800, which includes the numbers. But again, if every single person had a number, it'd be different. SMS, for example, we're not able to do in and out under that current cost structure. So many of the decisions we make are costs. About cost versus service, which I think we are in the process of evaluating a lot of those things to make the user experience better. People complain. People don't like having this, catch-all number, and then it's complicated. They're like, oh, the people that try to call, they get confused or whatever. In terms of costs, that seems to be the cheapest way to do it. And we didn't have there's not like a lot of setup costs. We didn't have to do an interconnect with an operator or anything like that.
So you talked about several stuff you are doing, like an open source lighting system or whatever. So where can we find this kind of information? Just I'm curious.
So we have a wiki, wiki.risematica.org. Some of that stuff isn't on there yet. Basically, I can explain a bit. What we found was that there's a lot of like telco solutions for these things, like no break, the sort of telco site no breaks, or like how do you ground a tower properly? These kinds of things are. Either you can like buy a full system and they're very expensive. So we kind of tried to figure out how can we reduce as many of those costs as possible and buy things that like buy the components and put them together in a simple way. So we use like varistors. So if there's any electricity coming in from a socket or whatever, a lot of times lightning will hit the electrical grid somewhere nearby and that will create a surge. Not all of that stuff is up on the wiki yet, but we will and hopefully get more of it up there. Sort of just like basic, how do you go about protecting a site? How do you decide if it's going to be hit by lightning or not? What are the sources you can look for to see how common it is for lightning to hit, what altitude are you at, so on and so forth. And then how do you protect based on that, and how do you do that in the least expensive way? So some of it requires like digging trenches and burying a shitload of copper.
I'm just saying because I feel it may be interesting, and not only for the physical stuff, but also maybe some tools that you use to operate the network may be useful for other people. I don't know, people using setting up the network at CCC, or so. I see that we could share more of these type of stuff probably.
Like I said, there's a lot of stuff on the wiki. Yep. It hasn't been updated in a little while.
It's in Rizomatica.org.
Yeah, sorry, it's just wiki.rizomatica.org.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Good.
This might come under the session tomorrow, but if I ask the question directly, you can answer it. So I would imagine that up in the mountains there, you have a big problem with rain fade when the showers come through on the Wi-Fi links. So how does your infrastructure deal with the recovery process if the link drops out? Because I imagine, just a guess, I would imagine at 2.4 gig you do suffer from that from time to time.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to answer that, Keith? Will you answer it? I don't know if you want to answer it. Will you answer it?
So I certainly saw a lot of problems on running the ABIS link over wireless. And what we did was I can't remember exactly what I did with optimizing these Ubiquiti equipments that to whatever, slowing it down as much as possible and turning off all of the extra speed optimizations, and that seemed to make it as stable as possible. If there's a rain shower comes and the ABIS link goes out, we probably don't really know about it because we don't really keep statistics on that kind of stuff. You know, that there's a lot of power goes out there anyway, and the people are just really used to the network coming and going. In terms of the Wi-Fi providers, the WISP providers that are providing these multi-hop Wi-Fi links up to the mountains, again, these things come and go all the time for various reasons, and we don't really have any insight into why, or don't really have any statistics. We don't really bother keeping, like,
that's good. I was kind of more curious to know what your experiences were with the Osmocom side of things, so that when a protocol error occurred between two entities, because quite often you expect it to be wired or over a link which is at least semi-reliable. I was curious to know what, you know, because I don't suppose you guys actually have, in your test procedures, routinely drop the ABIS out, routinely introduce nasty errors, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
so
yeah. I'll hand it to Harald. But yeah, we definitely did have a situation where we saw that, okay, it became obvious that the design and the thinking behind the ABIS over IP link was not, it was not taking into account that the link would come and go or that it would be unreliable.
So, I cannot really, I can just confirm that. I just wanted to make sure in terms of the architecture, it's clear that Rhizomatica runs a full network in the box in every given community. So only if there is multiple BTSs in one community, you have these Wi-Fi links between the BTS and the BSC and then the rest of the network. So basically in small installations, you have, no? Okay. Okay, at least that's my understanding. In small installations, you actually have everything in one location, and you don't have ABIS over any like wireless link. But it's no.
So we run the I will talk about it tomorrow. But we're basically doing transcoding from GSM full rate to G729 for the VoIP provider, and we don't do that on anything that's light-ish hardware, so it's running on a small fanless PC box that is we don't tend to mount on the tower. So we have if the tower is too far away from the building where that computer, and usually that computer involves a monitor as well, and it's usually the command and control center for the community to log into the web-based interface and do all of that stuff. So in most cases, it's that fanless PC running everything except for the Osmo BTS, which is running on the Sysmo BTS 2050 or 1020 or whatever it is on the tower. And oftentimes, a Wi-Fi link between the two.
My experience with the A interface is it's always come back. There's been some pretty nasty ADSL dropouts and network dropouts while we've been testing. And even when we were using the satellite link during that testing that I had the picture for, we could stand in front of the terminal, cause all kinds of strange IP-type delays, and it always came back up again. So I was just curious to know what, compared to your network, my network is in a laboratory. So it's very interesting to see what it's like in the real world with a really robust environment and difficult terrain. So.
We used to have a lot of problems with the ABIS, but actually Holger did some work with us, and he was very attentive to that, and whatever there was with the where the channels would get broken, which was something to do with the IP access, I think, rather than the Sysmo BTS and specifically. But now they time out and come back or whatever. But we did used to end up with the situation where all of the channels on the BTS were marked broken, and you had to drop it to get them back.
So I think that's probably it. I just want to say thank you to everyone that makes Osmocom possible, who builds hardware, who does all the things that make it possible for us to do what we do. I don't think we would be around if it wasn't for these open source projects. So thank you, everybody, and thanks for the opportunity to share our work.